Let everybody get settled. Okay, Mr. Cooney.
May it please the court. This is a case controlled by the REC Act. Congress's purpose in enacting the REC Act was to protection of other vessels plying the same waters as the sunken vessel, or essentially to prevent the creation of hazards to navigations. This is precisely what happened in this case. This is the reason this act exists, is to prevent vessels from running into sunken vessels. The search obligation under the Act is to ensure that a missing vessel does not constitute a hazard to navigation. In this case, ENSCO terminated its search without searching in any area where its rig could have been a hazard to navigation.
Do you have anything in the case law which indicates that that is indeed the search obligation? I think that's a really important point. You say that's the obligation. They say the obligation is to try to recover the vessel. This is really the crystallized question by the way you framed it.
Yes, Your Honor, and indeed the case law is not that well developed. We're in another area where these things apparently don't happen very often, and the two leading cases, the searches were quite complete. So we have to look at the statute. And what the statute says is that it's unlawful to have a sunken vessel in an area where it creates a hazard of navigation. And if you do, you have to mark it and remove it. Now, by implication, if you can't find the vessel, you can't mark it or remove it. And there is a no-fault duty to do that. So I would argue to the court,
it's a case of absolute liability, that in the vast ocean, if you didn't find this, then you are absolutely liable for whatever happens to somebody happening upon it.
It's an absolute form of absolute liability, but not as broad as Your Honor suggests.
Okay, so we're looking at areas, your limit on it?
Well, in areas where it could constitute a hazard of navigation, and by definition we're talking...
But the ocean is a big place. The Gulf is a big place. And ships are going around all over hither and yon and whatever. And so this idea that you have to go and search the entirety, because nobody's questioning that there was a search.
You're arguing they have to search the entirety.
Oh, absolutely not. And let me
search the probable navigable waters,
the area of high risk,
probable navigable waters in the vicinity.
There are really two or three factors.
Far was this?
This was 87 nautical miles.
Right. So it's not right there, and the it seems to me that they did in fact search where tides and the currents and the this and the that. And I mean, we have plane parts washing up 3,000 miles from where people thought they should be, and so this idea to me that you have to that in a huge body of water you have to either find the ship or be liable for what or the thing that dislodged here, or be liable for whatever happens to it. I mean, this was quite a ways away from where the
we're not saying
occurred.
That. Let me talk about the searches and then the areas that should have been searched if they had done the appropriate analysis. And there's a graphic that comes from one of the exhibits, a 527 chart, and then of record the two positions, and I've outlined the most where the vessel was in the most hazardous area that we could.
Let me just ask you though first.
Yes, sir.
Tell me, I mean, as I read Nunley 2, it's not a strict liability statute. And if you make a full, fair, good faith search and can't find it, that's the end of your obligation.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's a
gloss. You agree with that standard?
I agree with that standard. But the proper search standard has to be imposed, and then the standard is for the search, a fair and good faith search. And this is judicial gloss on the search obligation. We have not suggested, excuse me, Your Honor.
Why isn't that a factual finding? I mean, we have a factual finding here. And even though we have this issue of burden of proof, we actually kind of have it both ways. The judge said you all didn't really prove a lack of good faith, but then later says there was a good faith search. So I'm not sure the burden of proof is dispositive, but either way, we have a judge who looked at all of these charts and all of these experts and all of this stuff and said, good enough.
She applied the wrong statute because she didn't look at hazards to navigation. Let me talk about the two searches that took place and why they were.
Okay, wait a minute. I didn't get what you just said.
Let's look at the two searches that...
No, right before that. You said she applied the wrong standard.
She applied the wrong standard. The standard...
I thought the standard you were saying that was wrong was burden of proof, but you're saying it's something else.
No, I'm saying the standard is what kind of search you have to conduct. And the search you have to conduct is to determine whether the missing vessel is located, is sunken in a place where it constitutes a hazard of navigation.
But it's still a full good faith search.
But it's still a full good faith search once under that standard. But you have to search in areas where it would be a risk. In this instance, ENSCO didn't search any of those areas. Number one, the aerial search is only effective if the vessel is floating. We don't criticize them for searching by air to see if their vessel was out there floating. That's an appropriate thing to do. But the act focuses on sunken vessels. So that all that...
gone back into the area where there are navigable waters in the area probable, and they should have gone back after the fact and done the submarine, whatever, sub searches.
Absolutely. I think the standard requires that.
And they did not do that. They did it for a few days in the area right next to it. In the bigger area where the navigable was, and that's your case.
That's my case. They were in deep water. So in the waters that they searched, which were immediately adjacent to where the rig went missing, which is an appropriate thing to do, look and see if it's there. But what they didn't do after, I think, 7 days of subsea searching, is they didn't go to where the rig would have constituted a hazard of navigation. And the questioning of the witnesses was they were aware that it was going to the west-northwest. They were aware that that was shallower water, which triggers the hazard of navigation concern. And it's an area of high vessel traffic.
Let me ask you this. They were searching along what had been computed as a drift line, I assume.
Yeah, but with very close to the area where the vessel
was. How much farther would they have needed to go to find this sunken vessel?
The sunken vessel was 87 miles away, but...
And how far did they search along that drift line?
Well, they searched 10 square miles, an area by maybe 10 miles by 12 miles, you know, that sort of area.
See, that's the problem with the 87 miles. If we know it's there, then you go that linear sort of 87 miles. Within 87 miles of this, of where it, the rig comes unmoored or whatever the right term is, we've got to search. Then that's when you start making this exponentially bigger. They've been searching for that plane for... almost, you know, a year and a half, and are still looking. So I realize that's a little different, but my point is just that these are difficult searches to do.
These are findable things. Here, just look at the graphic for a second and understand this is not an exhibit, but taken from exhibits.
No, sit down. That's all right. You'll have your say later. Sit down.
The vessel sank, and I apologize, this is in fathoms, so it was 110 feet, which is roughly 19 fathoms. We know that probably 20, 25 fathoms and shallower becomes critical for a large object like this. This thing about the size of a football field. So in determining, knowing it went west-northwest, you can look at the chart and you can start delineating areas where the search should have been conducted. Because any deeper, it doesn't constitute a hazard of navigation. The way we see the act works is the vessel sinks in deep water, 2 miles, a mile, 500 feet, maybe 200 feet. It's not a hazard of navigation, so its existence on the bottom is not a violation of the act, does not trigger the marking and removal obligation. The obligation is triggered only if the sunken vessel is in shallow water in an area where it would create a hazard. So in answer to the court's question about this is a broad area we're talking about, it's actually a determinable area. And we're talking, you know, larger than 110 square miles, but not any sort of unlimited.
But, I mean, that's because we now know where it was. It's really easy now to find a plot that we say, had you done this, you would have found it. I mean, it's like when you're searching for something in your house, when you finally find it, you're like, oh, well, that was obvious, but it was a completely ridiculous place that it was until you found it, and you're going, oh, now I remember I left it up on that shelf because of this and that, but you had not, you know, you'd searched everywhere and not found it. So to me, it's very sort of after the fact hindsight to say, well, now we know where it is, and if you'd done X, Y, and Z, you would have found
it. We already knew where the general direction was going and no such search was done. We have 5.5 months of an opportunity to do analysis, to go out and try to find out where this extremely large object that clearly created a hazard of navigation was or might be. And let me suggest to the court that the test is not necessary to find the object, but to conduct a full and good faith search to attempt it.
And the district court found against you on that. I mean, that's a factual finding. This isn't like a summary judgment case where we could say there's some evidence or this or that. The court looked at this, considered way more than this chart and whatever else, and way more than we can do as an appellate court, and made a finding.
I would disagree, Your Honor. The district court below did not consider at all the factor of whether this constituted a hazard to navigation. If you looked at the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the phrase hazard to navigation or obstruction to navigation does not appear.
That's why we said at the beginning that it depends on whether the standard is search near where it's a hazard to navigation or whether it just means search to try to locate your vessel.
That's right.
And that's there's two the whole different, thing. And you believe the district court did the latter.
Did the latter, Your Honor.
And didn't even look at the hazard to navigation issue.
If the act means anything, it's not that you necessarily have to find your vessel wherever it's at.
But I do have a question. The findings seem pretty broad. And so while I may agree with you that there should have been some focus on that, the court says there's a good faith, and so wouldn't we have to find that was clearly erroneous?
No, I disagree, Your Honor, although, frankly, there's a number of findings that I think are clearly erroneous.
Well, the Coast Guard one is probably clearly erroneous.
Yes. Yeah.
Because the Coast Guard never approved or was supervising this. Right. But that I don't think that that's essential, though, to her findings.
Let me kind of back up a little bit. It's interesting that my opponents, in their analysis of the relevant case laws, particularly the Nunley case, say that one of the factors is whether the sunken vessel would constitute a hazard to navigation. The one thing the district court did not consider, clearly did not consider, is whether this sunken vessel would constitute a hazard to navigation and whether there was an obligation to rule out the possibility that this hazard to navigation.
Let me ask you this. What evidence is there in the record that further search would have been would not have been fruitful?
Would not have been fruitful. The record, since no search was conducted, I have to go and go back to some after the fact, after this. Clearly, the record was...
I want to know what testimony there is in the record that led the judge to find that a further search would have been fruitless.
The testimony was simply conclusory on the part of Mr. O'Connor saying... He's an INSCO. And they said after, essentially the timing is this. The government pulled the Inez McCall. They had basically loaned it to the. The minute that vessel disappeared, his testimony was they decided that it would not be fruitful, no factors given, nothing, that it would not, they're not likely that they would find the vessel. I suggest that that's not the test. The test is to go out and determine whether this very large object that creates, has the potential of creating a hazard of navigation, is out there somewhere lurking to get another shot.
What evidence support what you just said? That there was a reasonable basis to keep looking for the boat?
Because one, it hadn't been found, and they had only searched in areas where the water...
No, but evidence.
Well, the evidence.
Expert testimony?
Well, their evidence of where they searched. The evidence of where they searched was in deep water.
I would assume that you had some evidence that they should have searched longer and farther and...
Yes,
and
I had.
Find that in the record?
Well, basically, Captain Gilbert says you continue searching until... His position was, the Coast Guard's always position, is you search until you find it.
Well, you know that's not right.
But no, you can't, you know... Well, it's a laudable task, but that's not what we're talking about.
Do you have some expert that says if you would have done what the professional people would have done and hired a consultant and done this, you would have gotten this area and this would have been prevented. You don't have that expert.
I have the testimony. I have some cross-examination of the ENSCO people admitting that they were aware that as the vessel went into this area, it created a hazard of navigation. And I think Mr. Roach specifically admitted that they were aware of that and they decided not to go forward with the search.
Right, but you don't have to saying that if they'd been professional, in your way of thinking, that they would have found it or likely would have found it.
Right. I think
you don't have that testimony.
I don't have that testimony directly. No, you don't. Okay. Now, clearly the rig was discoverable. Number one, we discovered it. But number two, when they took the very same equipment, the Ennis McCall up there, they had no trouble finding it. So it was a matter of getting into the right area.
Well, once you know where something is, you can find
it. Oh, absolutely. But
I mean, to me, that is so poor as a standard, particularly as a standard for us to reverse a factual finding by the district court, that, well, it eventually was found and therefore found by running into it, and therefore it could have been found.
My red light's on, but all I can tell you, Your Honor, is that our view is that the standard utilized by the district court was incorrect, and because of that, the factual findings were skewed. We're incorrect.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Flint, tell me what your problem is with the exhibit.
It was not part of the trial court record, Your Honor. I never had an opportunity to ever examine any of their witnesses on it. It's out of scale. There's no marks on it. And I got it at 9 o'clock this morning.
Okay. Oh,
so I think it's inappropriate under...
I find it completely incomprehensible, so I guess that's...
If you all are going to look at a document, Exhibit 106, which we refer to as the amoeba document, and 116, which was the search parameters, are probably the most effective documents for your understanding of the case. I would like to point out a couple of inconsistencies. First of all, he was very careful to say 87 nautical miles. It's over 100 statute miles as we drive on the... Additionally, it's 119 square miles of the ocean bottom that we searched by sonar. We did 60,000 miles by
aircraft. What is the navigable area that where this could have gone?
All of it.
And how far? How big is that? Isn't that a pretty vast?
Absolutely.
So give me a...
There are three Lightridge areas out there, and the one that he's talking about is roughly the size of the state of Delaware, and about a third of the size of the state of New Jersey, if you look at it that way. And we looked at the most likely areas, all of which are navigable and all of which are subject to vessel traffic. The first things that we did is we skewed our search to look up by Lake Charles and Beaumont and all these places near the coast. We went all the way to Galveston. And as you recall, Galveston was hit incredibly hard, so getting boats and aircraft and things out in the aftermath of the hurricane were incredibly hard. Well, what did we do? We got the federal government to lift the no-fly zone. We went up and we searched. We found that we lost our rig in the first 24 hours. We notified the Coast Guard. 10 minutes later, we had an expert, Nelson Robinson. He was our consultant. CNC Technologies are some of the best people on the planet. In fact, some of the people in this case are starting to work on the Malaysian air disaster with their subsea stuff. We had sonar. We had a towed array. We had multi-beam. We got a vessel from NOAA. We searched for 11 to 12 days underwater search.
Does the record show, though, that you looked at the most busy trafficked navigable area in the probable storm path, knowing that it was going west the way
okay.
It was going? Does the record show that?
The record shows that we looked in the most likely area as to a company like Tidewater or Schwest or a tanker going into Lake Charles. We looked in their most likely.
You weren't
likely.
Looking at Sabine Pass, you know, this, where the ball, you weren't
looking
over there.
We looked at a 30-mile area going east to west, and in a the cone was expanding as we went out, okay?
What did you do about the thing that they say that you did not have an actual expert during the relevant time period?
I would suggest to you that CNC.
You just said you had the best experts. So.
CNC Technologies, along with Fugro Chance and Oceaneering, are the experts in underwater surveying and finding lost objects underwater. We use both Fugro and CNC. That's in the record. And one thing that was left out that nobody mentioned, on page 4074 of the trial record, I asked their only expert who had anything to do with maritime matters, do you have any problems with the ENSCO search? And he said no. That
no.
was Captain Gilbert. They put
but there's
on.
No evidence of somebody saying you were spending all your time over here and you should have been spending your time over there.
That's correct. He had
because
no.
that seems to be their argument now, which I had
exactly.
not really gathered. I mean, I read the brief and didn't get it in the same way that it's been articulated here, and that just may be me. But is saying that you have to look where the likely navigation is really as opposed to where the rig likely went, you're supposed to go look at where, if it didn't go where it likely went, it would go and cause the most harm, I think is what he's saying now. Well, and maybe said in the brief, I didn't read it that way, and that's fine. That's my perception.
Imagine if you believe their standard. One, as you picked up, we'd have to look at the whole ocean. But the first thing we're supposed to do is go over 100 miles away and look near Houston because it's a highly vessel traffic. There is vessel traffic. There's 3,100 manned or platforms that are manned in the Gulf. There's all kinds of traffic. We looked where the experts told us. Don't forget, we were able to get the Navy and NOAA to help us with our drift models, and we tailored our approach using their information.
How far, I mean, you had a drift path. How far down the drift path did you go?
About 30 miles. We went at least 10 blocks. And I'd also point out that the Sotillo experts said we should be searching to the north. He wasn't even close. On page 43, 42 of the trial record, your appellate record, he admitted that he was 24 hours after the storm, he was 100 miles away. So
was the vessel eventually found in the drift path that you had calculated, but farther down?
This isn't in the record, but the vessel would have hit the remains of our rig before we would have discovered it if we kept going north south, going out. So searching the entire Gulf of Mexico, it would have hit the remains before we got to it. That was not in the record, but those are the calculations. And we would have been searching something the size of the state of
Counsel, I have
Rhode
an
Island.
Issue with something in your brief that's
Certainly.
Really problematic to me. Her argument heading 10 in bold says they concluded the search for the rig with the consent of the Coast Guard.
Okay.
The Coast Guard did not give consent. The gentleman said he didn't object.
Correct.
But he wasn't in charge of monitoring your search, and it seems like you may have led the district court astray to act like you had the permission of the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard was acquiescing and advising. They were not advising. The guy was just a contact person. He didn't have any expertise in this, and this appears to be a very misleading argument heading. They never consented.
Okay, Your Honor, just so everybody knows, we complied with every Coast Guard regulation under Section 4.
Right, but this is not true, though, when it says with the consent of the Coast Guard.
We marked our wreck. Immediately, we marked our legs. And when they found the remains, we marked those. So we complied with 409. Now, with regard to the Coast Guard tells companies like ENSCO, clean up the pollution, do this, do that, okay? And when you have an accident like this, they were instructed to contact the Coast Guard every day, twice a day. They spoke, Mr. Sean O'Connor and Darrell Roach spoke to Lieutenant Commander Keister.
Right, but it was just informational. He was not supervising. If you read his
16-page
thing, but this says with the consent. He did not give consent for them to stop. He just didn't object or do anything to impose the Coast Guard's authority over the decision.
Well, if I may draw your attention to the record, Mike Landclose is our Coast Guard liaison for ENSCO, and he deals with them every day. And at one point during the search, Landclose asks, have we done enough? And I said, no, you have to keep doing more. So we get to the end of the thing. There are no more vessels available. The Inez McCall, the super ship with all the technology, goes back to NOAA, and we're left in a quandary. And at this point, all the experts are telling us the likelihood of finding this rig is very slim now. And in the only experience ENSCO had previously, when one got knocked off station, they found it, the 64 went south into deeper waters. And then the fact that the stuff washed up on shore in South Texas, that's when we started the secondary search over the Mexican and the South Texas economic zone.
I don't really feel like you're addressing this. Where in the record does it say that the Coast Guard consented? Are you referring to the answer where they said that I do not object?
Yes, ma'am.
That is not accurate.
41.
Then that is not. Will you at least concede that your brief is misleading or inaccurate? You may still win the case because
I understand. I concede that the Coast Guard did not consent.
Okay, and the brief says it does in bold.
All I would say is a police officer is telling you something and you know, you they finally let you go, they consented to let you go. I will agree with you, Your Honor, that they didn't consent.
Let me ask you, what, you said experts told you that there's no, you're not likely to find the wreck if you search further. What experts are
we? That would have been Nelson Robinson and the people at CNC who have been conducting the sonar technicians.
Did they testify to that effect?
They did not. Their records are in the the court record.
So is the only person?
What do you mean their record? Their report or what?
Well, all of their records are in, and a portion of the CNC people's were in it via deposition testimony. But if you recall, in this case, the plaintiffs put on their case. We started putting on our case, and then their expert came in. And at that time, I moved, and the judge said, "Am I only going to hear experts from now on?" And I moved at that time for judgment because they had not put on any experts, that we had not conducted a full good faith search. And the judge agreed. She had heard 32 witnesses. She'd seen 548 exhibits. And she said, not only did we do a diligent search, she said it was more than diligent in her findings of fact. So
I'm just looking for what record support there is for the fact that a further search was not called for.
The testimony came through Mr. Sean O'Connor, who the judge found to be a credible witness in finding of fact number 16.
He's a ENSCO employee?
Yes, sir. He's an engineer. He was a manager of engineering. He was the one that ultimately, a week into this, became responsible for the search.
Is that it? Is that the extent of the evidence?
Well, and they didn't put on evidence of that your search was faulty.
Correct. In fact, most of them had no comment about the subsea search at all.
But they don't have to put on evidence that your search is faulty. You have to establish that it was good.
That's okay.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that if you read Judge John R. Brown's decision in the Allied case, that they do.
I wouldn't say that I hadn't read it, but go ahead.
I was just going to say, in the last sentence, the judge found that the entity, the people, did not prove that the entity was negligent in their search, and accordingly, the owner of the sunken vessel was the
owner. I mean, that's an issue, and that to me is a question in the case as to who has the burden of proving either the lack of a good faith search or the presence of a good faith search. But it doesn't seem like the judge's ruling really turns on that.
No.
And the judge put the burden on the plaintiff, which is where burdens typically go, but then also later said affirmatively that you conducted a good faith search. So it seems like the judge found both.
You're correct.
No proof of lack of good faith and also good faith.
But the only evidence is Mr. O'Connor's testimony. She said that's what I'm relying on, right?
You had Mr. Roach dovetailed with Mr. O'Connor, and those are the two people who are primarily responsible.
Well, also, their expert's not criticizing the search, in my view, is some indication that it was, because you would think, even if it's your burden to prove, they're going to put on evidence as well to say it wasn't good faith. I mean, whoever's burden it is, that's the whole bottom line here. Was a good faith search done or not?
This was a fact-determinative case, and as you all know, these types of cases, good faith searches, and admiralty judges sitting in admiralty, the standard is clear error.
So if they could find an expert who would say there was something wrong with the search, you would think they would have brought him or her.
Absolutely, Your Honor. What I'd like to do is just kind of touch on some other things. There were some discussion of whether or not the judge used improper terminology, but in the Allied case and in the Nunley case, this court used terms like negligence and diligence and things of that nature. So I think that's important to notice. I would point out that the arguments about CFRs were not part of the trial court that came in on the reply brief.
And about what?
They weren't part of the trial court, Your Honor.
What was not part of it?
The argument about 33 CFR 64.31, you won't find that anywhere in the trial court discussion.
Do you believe that focus should be on whether or not a navigable water is obstructed, and that should be the focus of the good faith determination?
I think we're having a problem of whose navigable water we're talking about. We went and searched in most probable areas that would have been navigable waters to any number of companies plying the trades as...
Right, but do you believe that should be the focus, is navigable waters pursuant to the title and heading of the statute?
I think the focus should be the focus should be what the court has come up with. Because this is unknown, we marked what we found. Once you go and search, you search the most likely areas.
Okay, but is obstruction of the navigable waters the key, or is finding the vessel where, I mean, which is the key part of the wreck statute?
This is not under the wreck statute. This is what the Fifth Circuit has come up with to fill in.
I know, but I'm trying to look at the statute and interpret the statutory.
I think that I would, if we had looked in the lighterage area instead of closer, and they're more likely with these wrecks, or they're closer in time to the accident. So you look where you think the wreck's going to be.
So should the court care about the fact that the statute says obstruction of navigable waters is the heading for the statute in its determination of its good, when it writes this case?
I understand, Your Honor.
How we should be concerned about that?
Yes, but that statute concerns wrecks that you know where they are. That's the key difference. And if you read a very close reading of it, it's locate your wreck and then determine how it relates to navigable areas. In our case, nobody could locate the wreck. All of the experts were amazed that our vessel remains were found over 100 miles away. Never happened before. So I think you have to look to, realistically, the locale of where it happened, and you start your search there. You use your best efforts. You use the technology that we used, the technology that they both talked about in Allied and Nunley.
Okay, should we mention navigable waters in proximity? When we're writing the case, should we mention that as a concern, or should that be ignored?
I think you probably should mention it. It's one of the concerns. We identified five.
The problem is, let's say you had something happen out in the true dead center of the Pacific Ocean. Do you have to go to Hawaii and start searching around because that's navigable waters around Oahu or something?
No.
The problem that I have with what he's articulating is basically you have to find navigable waters anywhere remotely near where the incident occurred and start searching those, which I'm sure he would have criticized if you had not searched the area immediately. I mean, it's logical that when something goes missing, you search where it was.
Correct.
And in this whole search for the plane that's been thus far rather unsuccessful, they've been searching, you know, where it was and then the drift patterns and all that, which is exactly what you did. Now, I understand the argument that, yeah, but if you've got boats that are potentially going to hit something, that's where you should search. The problem I have with that, I mean, that sounds good, but the problem I have with that is that this is a vast area anyway. Even if you limited it to areas where there's a lot of boat traffic, there's a lot of boat traffic in the whole Gulf.
Certainly. You're also not going to see the term high vessel traffic anywhere if you do a computer search
of
the port record.
And you don't need to search water that's so deep that it's not going to hinder navigation. You don't have to go there.
That's correct, Your Honor. Everything south of our location where we set up, we were in 234 feet of water. No matter how, since the legs had approximately 280 feet into the dirt and the underwater, so no matter how you rotate the rig, things of that nature, it would not have presented.
So you were searching what you perceived to be a place where it was, because his argument,
absolutely,
as I understood it in the brief, was you only look to recover it as a matter of, like, benefit to you, salvage value, rather than looking to harm. But you're saying we didn't look where it would be deeper, where we might still have found it and salvage it. We did look where it might be a hazard.
We looked where it was perceived to be a hazard. We just
okay.
didn't look 100 miles away
right.
where they perceived it to be a hazard.
Right.
I do want to make sure that you all are aware of two very important stipulations. One, ENSCO was not at fault on September 12, 2008, when Hurricane Ike ripped the hull from the barge portion of the ENSCO 74, leaving the legs and putting the rig essentially on a walkabout. It floated over 100 miles. That's pretrial stipulation, Record of Appeal 2081 and 82. The second one was a trial stipulation that I reached with opposing counsel, and that was that when the crew completed their hurricane preparations and left the rig with the advent of the storm, The rig was in all respects seaworthy and fit for duty. That's found at...
Yeah, but nobody's arguing that. I mean, he's not arguing that it shouldn't have unmoored. He's saying that it shouldn't have... You should have found it.
The point I wanted to make, Your Honor, is they were talking about innocence and not at fault. We were not negligent when this was set in motion.
And yeah, but I think the negligence here is the search negligence question. And the burden of proof we can debate, but as I said, I think the court found it both ways.
I think you're correct.
So I don't know that the burden of proof, while important, is determinative here.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head because the judge said that we conducted a more than diligence.
But if the argument is, and this is what I'm having trouble getting my arms around, that the argument is, I guess, that you have to go, and this is the part I'm having trouble with, to the nearest high volume area and look, and what is that, and near meaning what, because the Gulf's a big place and has a lot of ships. So I'm having trouble with this search the hazardous place argument, which seems to be what's being articulated.
And I think you should.
Go ahead. Once you've answered her question, but I have a question.
Certainly. I was trying to just make the point that hindsight's 20/20. And in the aftermath, the ENSCO was diligent and did everything that was reasonable to search for its lost rig. And that's what the judge found. That's what the trial court found on a factual basis. And this is a clear error standard, which is the factual issue. Yes, ma'am.
What did the judge find about the cost-benefit analysis approach that's been argued by your opposing counsel? You know, the idea that you stopped because the free service was no longer available, and also that there were no the tools and equipment to do it were not available right then. They were being used by other people, but you didn't try to get them for in the future.
We did. John O'Connor's testimony was that he did look afterwards and they couldn't find anything. In order to modify, I'm over my time. Can I finish the question?
You can answer the question.
In order to modify a boat, it would take several months to put the equipment on it, and he testified that they did do some looking. He couldn't recall. That was the gist of his testimony. And the judge found that she found that our efforts were reasonable. I refer you back to paragraph 64 of her findings of fact.
Let me ask you this.
Certainly.
Did anyone calculate where they estimated the wreck would have been, say, when you terminated the search?
If you look at Exhibit 106, it's in the appellant's appendix. If you also look at Exhibit 119 and you look at them, that is, we call that the amoeba. That was where the experts thought it could likely be. And
no, but I mean in hindsight, did they estimate where it probably was when you terminated the search?
They thought it was probably south and not north.
I think what he's saying is now that we know where it was.
Correct.
Was it on its way there or already there when you terminated the search?
Oh, it got there within 10 hours.
Oh, okay.
It was on the bottom. That's why all the air that became moot, and I had the discussion.
Well, it got all the way to Galveston within 10 hours?
No, it got to its location in 10 hours, and it was on the bottom on between the night of the 12th and the morning of the 13th. So while we were all looking, it was on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico for the entire time we were looking.
Okay. Oh, wow. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Cooney.
First of all, when they stopped searching, they knew one thing. The areas they searched, the vessel was not there. There was no analysis done on their part, and it's their responsibility under the statute, we contend, to determine where the vessel might have been. That's what how searches work. Is you search an area, one thing, if you don't find it, you know it's not there, so you got to search someplace else. There was no analysis. Testimony is that none of their people had any experience or expertise in conducting a search.
Well, even, so they had experts, though.
By their testimony, their meteorologist was a meteorologist. He wasn't a search guy. CNC's involvement was very, very limited and released after 7 days. And specifically, they were asked, at the end, did you consult any experts to determine what next? They did not. They simply ended the search.
You didn't put experts on though to criticize.
Well, we criticized that our experts said that there was a continuing obligation
I don't know. That's not.
I understand.
Have any substance.
We did not have any expert that said you could have searched here or searched here specifically.
Well, and isn't that the argument you're now making? You're saying that you haven't, and you're basically saying that you have to go search where there are a lot of boats. That's anywhere in hundreds of miles from where the rig comes in.
Number one, we're not saying that. Number two, I think that they have an obligation to continue the search. It's their obligation to search. What we're saying, to try to clarify, is the search under the statute is not to find the vessel, but to determine whether the vessel constitutes a hazard of navigation.
Okay, but it's kind of the same thing, unless you say you have to search until you find it, which is what you're saying.
No, Your Honor.
Because they thought it had gone into deeper water. And so if it had gone into deeper water, then it wouldn't be a hazard to navigable. But what you're saying is basically you've got to go search the whole Gulf anywhere where ships are and see if it's there.
Their testimony is quoted in our reply brief as exactly to the contrary. Both Mr. Roach and Mr. O'Connor, who were running the search, admitted that it was headed, far as they knew, west-northwest, which meant shallower water and more ships, therefore a higher degree of risk. They were aware that that was happening and asked Mr. Roach, you were aware of that and essentially that this created a hazard.
They searched that path. They searched the likely path. And
no, they did not, Your Honor.
They didn't search it all the way as far as it got, but they searched that area.
And they found nothing. And so after basically 7 days, they had 5.5 months to continue this search. Our contention is that if you own a vessel like this, a rig, and you lose it, you cannot search for a few days and conveniently say, we're not going to find it because we didn't find it where we searched for it, and walk away. If that's the case, then the statute, the obligation of the statute is essentially gutted and has no effect. The obligation has to be continuing. And their obligation, and we contend one of the things we proved as part of their negligence, is they did not, when they got to this stopping point and the Inez McCall was not available, they didn't stop and consider, where do we go from here? And the counsel indicated that they couldn't get another vessel. I asked specifically, in the months afterwards, did you make any efforts, and this is in our brief again, it's in the record, did you make any effort to locate other similar vessels that would be suitable for searching? And the answer was no. They walked away from it. There is a cost-benefit analysis involved here, and there's an additional footnote, I think, in our brief that adds another factor, and that is once you find it, you've got to remove it. And we've got a vessel with petroleum on board, and it's got to be removed. And, in fact, it cost them, I think, $26 million when they found it. They didn't argue at all to remove this. And so you're sitting here, you can't find it.
Here's the inner hull. It would have been a lot more than $26 million.
That's the concern in this case, is had this been a little bit over, or if this had been what the lighterage area was intended for, single-hull VLCCs, we would not be here talking about $4.6 million in a bunch of bent steel. We'd be talking.
This is very, very factual. This is your closing argument to the district court, and it could have been a winner. I think this case could have gone your way, but that's the nature of fact findings, and it's not up to us to change that, in my view.
Well, I think one of the sad things here is we didn't have an opportunity to actually sum up the way this case concluded. But that be that as it may, I'm not arguing that as error. That's the way the thing broke, and unfortunately. But again, it's not the issue to find the rig. The issue is to eliminate the possibility that it constitutes a hazard of navigation out there in shallow water.
You have a red light.
What?
You have a red light.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't see that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We have your case. And court will stand in recess for a few